This is a slightly belated startup of the audio recording of the August 29th, 2018 climate change law class. We've just set the stage for discussing how to respond to climate change from a policy physical level. And basically, that means mitigation, adaptation, and intervention. And we're just starting to dig into what mitigation might mean. So, offhand, and here I'm just, this is a no penalty, no foul, free play, creativity question, because the readings for today don't really delve into a systematic or schematic approach to this discussion. So I'm asking you, based on what you know, citizens of the world, law, well-informed law students, what are some of the strategies you could think of that would target emissions? How can you get emissions to start going down, or at least stop rising so quickly?
Investing in renewables.
Okay. How? What policy can you set that would encourage a switch from carbon-based energy to renewables and carbon-free energy? Which I assume you mean by
tax cuts. Tax cuts would be one.
All right. What would be taxing?
Profits.
So if you have a company that uses carbon-free energy sources, they get a tax break?
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay. All right. So can I just call it financial incentive as a general category?
Perfect.
A gently legal way of saying bribes. Okay? Anything else? What's the first tool? Oh, I'm sorry, Elizabeth. You had your hand up before and I ignored you. I'm so sorry.
I was just going to say like carbon capture technology on like power plants, like smoke pipes and stuff like that, that captures it.
Okay. So, and that's sort of the same way, switching from carbon-emitting sources, you keep carbon-emitting sources, you capture CO2 and put it underground. So how do you get people to use it? How do you get people to adopt that mitigation strategy? What sorts of tools are available?
Yeah, I guess financial incentives or just like changing the law to require it.
What would the law say? Thou must?
Yeah.
You use the word require, right?
Shall do this.
Okay. The common term in environmental law is command and control. Congress or EPA points a long bony finger and says, thou must do this. All right? So we basically have bribing and command and control. Anything else?
Until it makes economic sense and people are forced to do it, people aren't going to switch because people don't make change.
So, are you saying give them a financial motive?
Yeah.
All right. Why is it they don't have a financial motive?
It's more expensive, potentially.
Why is it more expensive to just throw your CO2 and to catch your CO2 rather than just throwing it into the air?
It requires additional equipment, it requires additional personnel, additional training, retrofitting of plants, etc.
And if you don't do that, and you throw your CO2 in the air, what's the cost?
Zero.
You're sweating. Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
At the present time, it's zero.
All right. The cost to you currently
is zero.
Okay. So what you're suggesting perhaps is give people a financial incentive, not necessarily a check, but some reason why they might want to take that cost and incorporate it into the cost of their actions now. Okay. So what I might suggest there is, let's call it market tools. I'll explain what that means in a little bit. I suspect you guys may have been exposed to this in your property classes or your other classes, but things like cap and trade, things like carbon taxes, things like assessing some type of cost on carbon that gets baked into the price of the good, even if it's not a direct tax on the carbon. Anything else? I mean, these are probably the big three, I'll be honest with you. But be creative. How many of you do things voluntarily to reduce your personal CO2 footprint? You should be proud of that. What do you do? You're nodding your head yes, but very quietly. So.
Me?
Yeah.
You buy local foods.
Okay.
To reduce your footprint. Mm-hmm. Buy travel, so less trucks. Food travels a shorter distance.
All right, but local more foods are exactly driven by some of those concerns. How do you know which foods, if you look at a shelf, how do you know which are which?
Well, that's a whole other debate, but a lot of them have a little sticker that says local. the grocery store.
So it kind of is.
What about going to the simpler, I mean, the basics of educating people? Because I know some people don't even know their footprint. They don't even know it exists. Okay, there's, for us, I think it's second nature because we're studying it. But I'm sure some people out there don't even know what the term your carbon footprint means.
Wow, your two answers, like to use a loaded term, it almost sounds like you colluded on them. because what you're really talking about essentially is identifying and providing information and then equipping people to understand what that information means. So if I could just put the general category here, informational strategies. And before I do, I'll just simply flag for those of you who are following, we'll talk about this a little bit, but this is things such as toxic release inventories, things about truth and disclosure, about environmental impacts, things like labeling certain types of foods to reveal their environmental impact. There's no law that compels you to do anything in response to that information. But we can talk about the fact that this has actually turned out to be an enormously powerful way to change behavior without the force of compulsion behind it. I'm sorry, I saw someone's hand go up and I just barreled on a head.
Well, you kind of said it already, but I was going to say like carbon labeling, like they do in the EU or that some state, I think California started doing something like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Anything else? This is my creativity moment. Oh, I'm sorry, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Could you like appeal to morals? Like the whole idea of sustainability is having a planet with the same like resources and whatnot for our future.
That is fascinating. All right, now I'm going to do my own informational disclosure. These are the four I walked in with. So when I asked you, this is the blank space. I'm looking for you guys to throw things out that I haven't thought about. Elizabeth, that is a fascinating one. Because, and I think you and I have talked about this before, one of the most interesting issues, at least from my perspective right now, is to what extent religiously motivated environmentalism gets treated differently under federal environmental law.
I know the Pope came out and said, I mean, the Pope Francis, his whole, the focus of his message this year is for the environment, taking care of the environment. And at least the religious community, like, this is the first time we have, you know, to have the Pope really come in and focus this means meant a lot.
So you're referring to the papal encyclical on climate change?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. To a certain extent, throwing carbon in the air isn't economically inefficient. It's not something that has a long-term consequence to us as citizens. It's a sin. If we can press a moral message, that might also be a very effective lever on changing behavior. Elizabeth, this is your comment. How would you like to label it? I don't want to call it morality, unless you do, or philosophical, or you know, the voice of God, Deus Ex Machina. Right?
I'm just like appealing to morals generally. It doesn't have to be religious just the idea that
so, you know,
future generations should be able to benefit from the same things we are able to.
So moral suasion. I like it. I'm not sure how you harness it, because there's been an argument in historical terms that some religious denominations have actually adhered to beliefs that have had enormous environmentally damaging effects. But you're absolutely correct. If you take a stewardship approach, a lot of religions are very strong on climate change action and they do something about it. I'm just not sure how you shape and mold that as a policy perspective from the state side without getting yourself entangled in some very interesting constitutional questions. But I think that sounds like a law argument for you. All right, any others before we move along? Yes?
Did your informational note contain like you mentioned, you said voluntary, so you can set targets or do policy guidance documents that are not binding.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an informational?
Yeah. Say, for example, EPA can't say you must have this energy efficiency in your appliance.
Right.
They can put an Energy Star label on it and let consumers know that EPA has vouched for the fact that this reduces CO2 emissions by buying this product, by reducing energy use.
Well, they could even adopt some kind of, along with industry, they could adopt like a footprint metric.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a voluntary. But I'm not saying it needs to be for the standpoint of the consumer's information, could just be from the standpoint of the methane-producing cattle ranch guy that wants to say, oh, this is the target the government said it's okay, so I'll do this, without it being used as a marketing ploy.
Absolutely. And I'm going to risk getting a spoiler on myself. That is going to be a topic of discussion that EPA actually has drafted exactly those kinds of guidances. Albeit in the context of air permitting frameworks, but nonetheless they have a double use that can serve that purpose. All right, excellent. You guys, I think, intuitively captured the spectrum of types of things that mitigation can capture. So what I would like to do is kind of provide a little bit more detail. So here, stop me, throw a yellow flag if I start sprinting along or using acronyms. But the key things are this. Command and control is what it sounds like. You give a federal agency or state agency the capacity to compel someone emitting greenhouse gases, be they CO2, be they methane, be they sulfur hexafluoride, whatever the greenhouse gas is, to say you can't or you can't unless you get a permit. That's it. There are a lot of people, including an extraordinarily smart environmental lawyer I'm married to, who think this is the right way to go. That a lot of the other methods we're going to talk about have too many flex and give and gray to be truly reliable. And to a certain extent, there's a bit of also a bit of Elizabeth's moral suasion argument. If you use these other tools, to a certain extent, you're condoning emissions when command and control basically sets a firm, bright line that you have to meet when you emit. So, for example, command and control, the primary paradigm we're going to talk about here in this class is the Clean Air Act. The Clean Air Act does provide a comprehensive framework for permits for the emission of air pollutants by major sources in the United States. Air pollutants has already been deemed, as we'll talk about on Wednesday next week, to be a broad enough term to encompass carbon dioxide. What does that mean? Effectively, you have some of the pieces in place to take the machinery that's used for things like emissions of mercury or ozone precursors or particulate matter and apply them to CO2 emissions and essentially dictate directly how much a source can emit. The catch with command and control, and it may be one of the other factors that apply here, is that essentially the criticism of command and control in this context is that the government or the agency rarely possesses the full body of information to provide the most innovative, the most creative, the most efficient solution. By means of bureaucratic uniformity, no criticism to the agency or the person involved, you have to choose one solution typically that underlies most of the permit limits. Frequently referred to as either best available control technologies or best system of emission reductions. That uniformity means that one source may drastically overspend to control their CO2 emissions. Another one may use a technology that EPA may approve, but in its context is not effective. So I'll pause here. Command and control is pretty straightforward. I won't necessarily spend a lot of time on it in this discussion, other than just to mention to you that here's a quick list of examples of command and control options that are already on the table. And we'll come back to them starting not next week, but the week following when we dig into the Clean Air Act. Program number one, prevention of significant deterioration.
PSD. That is the big program that is currently used right now.
I should rephrase. That was used to regulate CO2 emissions from major sources in the Clean Air Act. The next one, CAFE standards. Basically, automobile fleet efficiency standards for fuel consumption. Why is that a command and control CO2 strategy? The fundamental dynamic we have to deal with here is that CO2 is the inevitable byproduct of the combustion. You can't typically burn without generating CO2 in most contexts. Or at least you certainly can't burn carbon in that context. So as a result, when you control how much fuel is burned, that's essentially a surrogate for saying how much CO2 is being emitted. Corporate fuel efficiency standards, corporate automobile fleet fuel efficiency standards, as a result, have an enormous impact on sectors, transportation sectors, CO2 emissions. And it's a direct command and control strategy for reducing CO2 emissions even if it's not something you and I individually have to do, but the fact is the cars we can buy must meet these standards. In addition, keep in mind another command and control strategy, renewable portfolio standards. Go back to Austin's comment. That same dynamic, when you burn carbon, you emit CO2, means that if you compel utility scale power sources to switch from coal and natural gas to renewable sources that are carbon free, like solar, wind, and hydropower, you end up effectively controlling CO2 emissions by targeting the surge. So RPS standards are essentially command and control CO2 mitigation strategies. The last one I'll mention, just because it's important, it will come up again later in the semester, and I'm holding off on it because the field of battle is shifting as we talk. States set standards. In particular, even where the federal government is embroiled in a debate over how and whether to regulate large-scale CO2 sources, states are moving ahead. California, in particular, being most notable. California already has command and control dictates on how much CO2 can be emitted from large-scale sources, including power plants. So that's a short menu of command and control options. And it's intuitively obvious, isn't it? Any questions about command and control before we move on to the jungle that is market controls?
I mean jungle is not a pejorative sense, just sort of a fun, complex, changing one.
All right. I'm going to pause here because I always commit the cardinal sin of telling you things you already know. So, how many of you have already been exposed to the concept of market-based measures as a regulatory device in your other classes? Property, ad law, nothing? I get to warp your minds first. Okay? All right. This one is one that I've been trying to distill down in a very short fashion. Yes, I'm like rubbing my hands like a evil movie villain. I'm going to commit Rita's sins of sacrificing complexity and accuracy in the interest of clarity. Here's the model. The idea is that we shouldn't regulate pollution with command and control structures. We should just get out of the way and let the market do it. The paradigm that underlies this approach is that pollution is nothing more than a market failure. How so? Remember our discussion previously. It doesn't cost anyone anything to throw CO2 into the air. It's free. The person who does it accrues all the benefit to themselves. The person who suffers the cost are other people who have to deal with the consequences of that CO2. In economic terms, that simply means that the disposal of CO2 into the air is an externality. It's a cost that is not incorporated into the cost of generating the good. You essentially get it for free. As a result, the price you have to charge for your product is artificially depressed. You make more of it. You have every incentive to make more of it. You have no incentive to control the cost associated with the externality you're not responsible for. So as a result, this theory holds is the solution is to internalize externalities. Boom, you're done. Once you do that, everyone is self-motivated to stop polluting, to figure out ways to reduce pollution, figure out ways to maximize their profit by figuring out more efficient ways to operate and minimize the environmental footprint. Now, is that clear for everyone so far? I'm out of curiosity. Has anyone here had an economics background? All right. Okay, good. So I can speak with impunity today. All right, so why is this relevant in the environmental world? It turns out that there are two concepts I want to share with you that you have to keep in mind besides externalities and the internalization of them into your price signal, which is the tragedy of the commons. Nice. Now that one you guys have heard about. I see heads go up, but now I assume in property class.
Yes.
So you've all heard about the sheep in the field. That's the classic metaphor. The same way I was talking about throwing pollution in the air, you get all the benefit and none of the cost. Well, the idea of a tragedy of the commons is that everyone owns the same common good. It means that if I put something extra into that common good, where I take something from that common good in the exact same way, I get all the benefit of it. And society as a large bears a small fractional cost of the degradation or loss of that common good. The problem with the tragedy of the commons is everyone has the exact same incentive structure. The rational choice is for all of us, if we were sharing a large field and we each had one sheep, well, I might put my sheep on, an extra sheep on in the middle of the night, get twice the profit, a little bit less grass for everyone else, but only, not really a big loss. And then just sort of everyone sees the next morning that I'm getting twice as much. Your reaction? You're putting your own sheep out there, aren't you? So it becomes a runaway dynamic. The tragedy of the commons simply means that commonly held goods or public goods are structured usually in a way to incentivize individually rational choices that have communally damaging results. And it's a runaway dynamic. Now, I will pause and simply say there's some empirical research saying it's not always necessarily so, that there are examples where communities have figured out ways to solve this problem through essentially cultural norms that have lasted for thousands of years. But effectively, environmental law presumes that the tragedy of the commons will happen absent a rationalization of economic motives or command and control. So, what does that mean? It means you need to redo the market to solve these market failures, to internalize that externality, to figure out a way to get around the tragedy of the commons. So, what are the mechanisms to do that? What are the ways to do that? Normally, I would torture you with saying, what ideas do you have? But I suspect you guys already know the things I'm about to say. And we also have so much ground to cover, I'm going to cheat a little bit and use a Cliff Notes with you. The first is, and this is the favorite of, I think it's a favorite of a lot of folks. I don't want to put any particular political brand on this one, but essentially, privatization. Turn that public good, make that common field we all share into a private property right. If instead of everyone sharing the same meadow, we each own 1/100th of it, we have every incentive to make sure that that 1/100th works and not to put too many sheep on it. And by essentially atomizing that collective good, the market can step back in and you lose that externality effect. So how do you privatize some public goods that we're talking about here? Well, essentially, you say that someone has to essentially pay either person who holds a property right to the atmosphere, interesting question, or effectively someone who has to pay the damages caused by their emission in a way to offset the cost they're imposing. So that essentially means you have to get an authorization to emit a ton of CO2. It's usually called an allowance. You might get an allowance for 1 ton of CO2 for 1 year. You can also get allowances for 1 ton on a perpetual basis. That effectively means that you can essentially give emitters the allowances they need, and then if they go up and they don't have enough allowances, they have to go out there and buy allowances from someone else. Now, if the market has already been fully allocated, that means they have to find someone else who is not as profitable as they are and buy them out. That means the invisible hand of the market is starting to reach down and reallocate the allowances to the most profitable allocation, the one that's most efficient at generating social goods. You end up shutting down the older, higher emitting, lower profit facilities in exchange for newer, lower emission, more profitable ones. No government involvement. No command and control, no bureaucratic overhead, no infringement on property rights. It all, in theory, happens transparently and automatically. So, number one, privatize and then market. That's when we talk about cap and trade. You essentially cap how much CO2 every facility can emit. You give them allowances for each source to emit under that cap, and then you let them trade. Now, I'll simply say this may to someone who has not been exposed to this concept before, and I don't think this is true very much anymore because this type of market mechanism is very common in other areas. It strikes some people as a bit odd to essentially market clean air, to market clean water. We have markets for water as well. But it has been done for decades. The first program was actually instituted back in the 1990s for sulfur emissions that affected acid rain, and it tends to work. We've had dramatic reductions for far less cost than you would otherwise would have seen. That's why there's so much interest in cap and trade for CO2. And we'll talk about some of the legislative proposals that originally proposed this approach. Before we go on, I just have to say, though, because people tend to be real cheerleaders for this concept, what would be a problem with a market mechanism like this? I'll give a hint. Enron.
People lying.
I'm sorry? Lying and...
how much you can fudge the books. You can say you only emitted this much when you actually emitted this much and there's no one there. Mm-hmm. It's actually capturing your CO2 and then determining how much it is and
Sure.
They do like their startup and shutdown and the times when they don't have to, they're only, not all power plant emissions are reportable emissions. So they tend to do these burnings at times that it's not being counted. So what they're legally required to report is going to fall within and they just burn extra at the times that they don't have to count it.
Sure. So bad faith, maybe even criminal behavior.
Yeah.
In economic terms, maybe a less pejorative, rent-seeking, arbitrage, market manipulation. How many of you recall the shenanigans involved when California went to a market approach for electricity purchases? Instead of saying how much you had to make, they let the market choose. And that's why I whispered Enron to some extent. Do you remember some of the code names associated with the ploys that the traders used?
Yeah.
You know, things like Dark Star.
They would black out.
Yeah.
I remember those phone calls. They would be laughing. They would be like, oh, Grandma can't bake her cookies and stuff.
Literally laughing. Literally. They sounded like movie villains.
Yeah.
The point here is that market manipulation is a real challenge, either illegal or I'll just gently call extra legal. For example, suppose you own 10 power plants. You intentionally create a shortage by shutting down 4 of them for maintenance. Or for other reasons. As a result, people need to get certain types of emission credits or output. You create an artificial spike in the price and then you lock it in. This all sounds a little bit crazy, but let me offer the thought that in China, and I think this is fair to say because the New York Times documented this in a series of articles about 10 years ago, there were manufacturers of certain types of air refrigerants who essentially opened new facilities intentionally designed to be high emitters, with the idea being that then when they were given money to reduce those emissions, they effectively made a profit off the emission credits rather than the facility themselves. So market manipulation is real. It does happen. And unless you're very careful about how you structure it, how you police it, which is, again, bureaucratic overhead you're hoping to avoid, you can create little problems for yourself. The alternative to cap and trade, and this is one economists frankly prefer, this is the one you're hearing the most debate about, and this is the one that's being proposed currently by the Climate Leadership Council, which is Jen Baker's work group that the Republican, that was proposed by the Republican Conservative Coalition to President Trump when he first took office, is a carbon tax. Why bother with markets and the hyper-complexity of options trading and arbitrage and puts and calls and CO2 emission credits? Just put a price on it. And then let the market internalize that cost, and then naturally people will move away from high carbon items or items that generate a lot of carbon because they're just more expensive. Then you don't have to worry about who gets what credits and how they get traded and what sort of futures issues to deal with. Idea here is that you just go to the place where the market, where the generation of carbon emissions is most consolidated, the smallest group, and let them pay the tax, and then it trickles down to everyone else as that good is put back into commerce. So just off the top of your heads, what sector do you think would be the most likely place where most of the carbon is going to be consolidated in the smallest number of people that you could tax easily? Would it be people who drive cars?
It's not a small group.
No. Gas station owners?
Private jets?
Private jets. I liked it just for the social justice aspect.
It's a small group that emits a lot, has a large footprint.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Or just aviation, airplane companies in general?
Yeah.
All right. What's the bigger group? Airplane companies around the world or the people who sell fuel to them? I think your intuition is telling you that, but that is the right answer. Most economists say that you want to get as far up the chain as you can, which means you're really talking about the people who generate the carbon fuels that other people burn. So as you might expect, the ones who are most in the crosshairs of carbon taxes are the people who make hydrocarbon fuels or generate hydrocarbons. So on the plus side, it's a small, comparatively, manageable group that has the sophistication and resources to adequately and appropriately implement carbon tax. On the minus side, it's a small, well-funded group that has the knowledge and political wherewithal to fight like hell against it. So I'll simply say carbon tax is a solution that every economist loves, but never seems to get off the launch pad. I'm going to date myself here. How many of you remember Read My Lips? George H.W. Bush? Read My Lips, No New Taxes. Then, of course, he passed taxes, and he got crucified, one-term president. Taxes are political poison. Cap and trade has basically been called a carbon tax, and that's part of the reason why it's had so much political difficulty getting off the launch pad. All right, any questions so far about those sort of basic concepts? All right, then I will say it's not all or either one of these two. There are lots of hybrids available. We'll talk about those as we start getting into some of the regulatory standards that have been crafted, but essentially you can have what are called collars. Essentially, you have a market that allocates the credits until it gets to a certain point where it's deemed to be socially undesirable. In which case, at that point, there's a kick in, you get a mandated cost, but it's effectively a tax. So it's a market plus tax. The tax only kicks in when the market gyrates and spikes to a point where people feel there's undesirable consequences from that. All right, so that is market tools. Would y'all mind if I just not write cap and trade and tax and trust you guys to follow along in your notes? All right, to anyone watching, I hope that you're taking notes too. All right, then financial incentives. What are some examples of that? And Austin, I'll yank you into the light since you're the one who suggested this.
Oh, I was still thinking like taxes on carbon while I was.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's sort of a negative set.
But
I guess that's fair.
Making it easier to make more money selling renewable energy than it is to make fossil fuels, or market fossil fuels. Okay. That's where I was going with it.
So,
or like a tax incentive to buy a green car opposed to a diesel truck.
Like when you buy a Tesla, you get the tax incentive. Like it's deductible, right? Not deductible, but...
Sorry, my heart just beat a little faster when you said that. Someday I'd love to get a Tesla, I won't lie. But anyway, let's keep going.
I mean, yeah, because I'm just reading, because I know I have a friend willing to buy a Tesla, apparently, because you get tax credits
mm-hmm.
when you buy it. So I know some people really like that.
Right, tax credits, if I could. I think that's what Austin's also talking about. The concept is not that you put a financial price tag. Instead, you actually give someone money if they engage in the conduct you want them to do. And side note, I'm sure we're all familiar being good Houstonians that the current energy infrastructure, the current energy industry, is a beneficiary of a vast array of financial incentives and tax write-offs, accelerated depreciations. And I'm in no way criticizing that, just simply pointing out that the thing about financial incentives is when they're baked into tax rebates or incentives or depreciation schedules, they're less visible. As opposed to a carbon tax, which is very easily visible and very trackable. Financial incentives can be done in such a way that they are less apparent and therefore less subject to political attack. What are some examples of financial incentives? We already just talked about tax credits. There's one, for example, that's just come out this year, a 45Q tax incentive, which is effectively is going to give a tax credit for every ton of CO2 captured and sequestered under the ground. Essentially, it creates a revenue device for an operator who wants to create carbon capture and sequestration facility, especially if it's being used for oil enhanced secondary recovery, and essentially monetize that credit, that tax credit, by including it in the price valuation of the facility. What does that mean? Essentially, you could have people taking and building a facility and generating this tax credit and then they flip the facility to someone who wants to buy to take advantage of the tax credit. It's a very powerful tool to incentivize behavior that otherwise the market honestly doesn't incentivize at the first point, because the startup cost and the demonstration of technology and the scaling up of it can present an insuperable barrier without this kind of financial incentive. Others, feed-in tariffs. Have you all heard of those? Feed-in tariff is in electrical markets, but it basically, a feed-in tariff basically means if you generate a certain kind of power into the grid, and it's on a type of source that is preferred by the tax code, you get a certain amount of money for every megawatt you feed into the grid. So, for example, Germany had a feed-in tariff for solar-generated power, which was enormously influential at incentivizing people to put solar photovoltaic cells on their roofs. We have similar types of incentive structures built in some states for effectively creating a monetary stream for every megawatt that's generated by wind power put into the grid. Another quick example, well, we already talked about renewable portfolio standards, but there's also something called RINs, which effectively is the same thing but for renewable fuels. The idea is that basically, if I generate a fuel from a renewable source under the tax code, I get not only the money from the sale of my fuel, there's also a separate renewable credit associated with it. Refiners have to get and buy and or obtain enough numbers of credits that have to be associated with the volume of fuels they put onto the market. So what does that mean? It means that if I make a biofuel, I can sell my biofuel, but I can separately sell as an incentive this RINs, this renewable, but essentially the renewable credit generated that parallels the actual fuel itself. It's separated, it's sold. You have an entirely different market for those RINs. That's an incentive structure because effectively you get money for that separate credit. I'll say the short story of financial incentives is that they've been very, very effective for particular industries. The wind industry has been beneficiary of, for example, tax incentives that have been a perennial political battle, but are still in place at this point. We'll talk about those as we get to the end of the semester. All right, the last two, informational and moral suasion. Informational, I'll simply say, is a psychological strategy. It's not a policy for legal strategy. It simply says that people, when presented with information that highlights the true nature of the cost associated with the things they'd like to do, will naturally, or many times will choose, to adopt an environmentally beneficial course of action. So I mentioned some of them previously, but Energy Star appliances. That is a program that is not mandated by any federal law, but essentially it was created by EPA to allow industry to submit particular appliances to be tested, and if they met certain criteria, they got the Energy Star logo on the side. The reason that mattered was that consumers prefer Energy Star approved items. That informational signal has been enough to generate a change in behavior that has environmental consequences. Other prime examples of informational strategies, there's the toxic release inventory, which basically is a federal law that requires every major facility that emits regulated hazardous substances to report to EPA once a year how much they emit, be it to water, be it to air, be it injection, and then those pollutants are made publicly available. I will tell you from personal experience, there's nothing a company hates more than being listed in the Dirty Dozen every year. NGOs are very good about compiling information and making publicly available who the worst emitters are. No law, no compulsion, no command and control, no market incentive. The simple information itself will compel companies to spend an enormous sum to reduce their emissions to stay out of that information disclosure spotlight. The idea is that we can try and use the same types of approaches for CO2 emissions, but that informational strategy has its own challenges I'll simply say we will talk about reporting rules. And the criticism of reporting rules is, one, they impose cost of their own. You have to find out how much you're bidding, and you have to go through the paperwork of reporting. And two, it creates an issue where a reporting metric may be unfair to some groups in favor of others. How do you measure how much methane is emitted from a pig sty as opposed to a pipeline? How you choose that methodology can have a big impact as to who gets ranked above the other. And then suasion. I'm wrestling with the best way to put this, Elizabeth, though. You have, it's your concept, so call me out if I'm not doing this right. But I would suggest that suasion, usually I see it pop up as a regulatory issue in criminal enforcement. The reason I'm pausing is I'm unaware at this point of anyone who has been the target of criminal prosecution in the climate change or carbon emission arena, with only one exception. And that is, remember the RINs I talked about, the RINs, the credits associated with generating renewable fuels? It turns out that's an enormously lucrative and attractive market to organize crime, because it's easy to generate fake RINs. And people just sell them, just like counterfeit cash. The catch is, if you're a company that's bought a RIN and you discover it's fake, well, the problem is EPA doesn't care. And I think I'm being fair. Their position is a company bears the obligation of making sure they're buying legitimate RINs, and if they are relying on a fake one, that's their problem. And they're out of the compliance of the law, strict liability. And they pay the penalty, they have to find the right RINs. But the person who makes the fake RINs goes to jail. And we've had dozens of prosecutions putting people behind bars for exactly that. Beyond that, I know that's kind of a harsh, dark, negative vision of moral suasion. I'm not sure how to turn moral suasion into a strategy that's positive to encourage people to do it, other than modeling good behavior, perhaps, praising the people who do it well, educating children to make their parents feel bad if they aren't doing it. All right, thanks. Flip. Yes?
Excellent. Let's, why don't we just make it easier for the general public?
How so?
In Europe, it's easier to take public transportation, or it's very common for them to ride bikes or walk everywhere, but it's kind of hard to do here since everything's so far away. There's no public transportation. Also, make it easier to recycle things. So I know, like, when I lived in Katy, in my neighborhood, they would charge if you wanted to recycle. Where in Europe, like, they have separate food garbage and plastic and paper, and then they have different people coming to pick it up, so it's a lot easier to
Absolutely. I'm only pausing because that's such a fascinating and big suggestion, because when you have a hammer, it's like a nail. Right now, there's a lot of interest in using nudges to change behavior, essentially structuring situations that people intuitively want to make the right decision despite their otherwise natural inclination to do things that might, be less troublesome for them. You can pre-bake the way people live their lives in such a way that it's easy to use low-carbon alternatives like mass transit. It's easy to recycle and reduce CO2 emissions from things like aluminum.
And also in Europe and in Germany, they find you if it's not recycled. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not sure it's moral suasion, but it's kind of in that general category. Do the right thing, which is probably the better label for this. Yeah, okay. Any others? All right. So here's the challenge, the thing to think about. I'm sorry. There is one other I'll add at the bottom here. I didn't mention it simply because it's kind of an outlier. But let's call it technology, otherwise moonshot. If our problem is that right now our current technologies inevitably generate CO2, rather than figure out ways to squeeze existing technologies and throttle down CO2 emissions, do a jump. Do a moonshot. Figure out a different way to generate the same good without the CO2. And essentially, let technology, the same way we jumped away from land-based phone lines straight to cellular technologies for some emerging countries, figure out a technology that people can transition to that avoids this whole situation. Which is why this plant tour I'm talking about next Thursday. So interesting. It's that kind of disconnect technology that might break some of the rules of presumption we've been talking about in this class so far and present a different, radically type of new solution. The problem, of course, is, you know, this is, you can't rely, was it, hope is not a strategy? You know, we can't know what that innovative solution is by definition. We can kind of hope, we can guess, but it's hard to make that a hardcore, reliable strategy for long-term climate strategy. All right, so what I'd like you to think about a little bit is how to adapt this to Texas, very briefly. And essentially, these all sound nice. These are all kind of straightforward tools. These would, you know, sort of make common sense, I think, in most contexts. But how do you operationalize them? Let me give you a few ideas that have been the dominant approaches so far in climate policy. And the first one is wedges. And one of the readings on does include a similar graph. The idea is simply this. None of the technology fixes we could talk about, reforestation, switching to renewable energy, low-emitting cars, nuclear power, biofuels, none of them have a prayer of solving the climate problem. They're just not big enough, even the scale to the maximum, to offset this gigaton scale of emissions that we're talking about. So Professor Robert Sokolow of Princeton proposed in 2008, if I remember correctly, that the smart way to go about this is to break it down. And essentially, the recipe works like this. This is the current rate of emissions of their business as usual scenario. And here's where they're projected to keep going. What he did was he figured out that slope, and he figured out if you want to get to essentially stabilize emissions, this is the amount of emissions that you have to reduce by 2050. He took that total sum and then basically divided it evenly into seven wedges, and then assigned for each wedge a particular approach, one being full nuclearization of energy production, one being full use of renewable energy sources for fuel production, one being changing carbon-based utility-scale electricity production to non-fossil fuel production. And essentially, his position was that you don't have to put all your chips in one technology. If you have a portfolio and you assign each of the wedges a certain amount, collectively, you can get to a plausible scenario where you can hold emissions flat. The idea as well is that the cost associated with each wedge wasn't grand compared to the total economic output of the global economy. The catch is, each of the wedges alone is an enormous policy lift by themselves. Picture right now fully maximizing the development of new nuclear energy production to offset new coal-fired or natural gas-fired power plants. I think I'll simply say the wedge concept is still prevalent in policy discussions on climate change. It has been updated. The current number of wedges on the table right now is 9 wedges rather than 7. Each one is a gigaton of CO2 emissions, if I remember correctly. The catch here, or sorry, 2 gigatons. The catch here is that slope is still going up. The wedges have not been put into place. And the longer we keep emitting, the harder it's going to be to find a wedge that's big enough to offset the increased emission amount. I will say that it's looking more and more like wedges may not be enough by themselves, but just be prepared. You're going to run across the wedge concept if you talk about any kind of global international approach to greenhouse gas emission reduction. The other critique of wedges is buried here. All these do is try and stabilize CO2 emissions currently already in the atmosphere. This amount already, as we talked about in our first class, is guaranteed to generate already about 1 degree centigrade increase in surface temperatures. And over time, it's projected to get to 1.8 degrees centigrade. So that has already some severe ecological consequences. Tool number one, wedges. Any questions about that so far? I should also say the revision I talked about with the 9 wedges, that only gets us down to 660 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. So it's already another 40% above what we currently have. So clearly wedges,
they've got a ways to go to be a truly effective approach. The other thing to think in mind about is which wedges do you go with first? Which ones make the most sense? And I think what I would suggest to you, and this we'll talk about in a little bit, choose the no regrets wedges first. The ones that you would do anyway, because they either justify the cost or they have other economic or environmental benefits. The other concept, and we'll talk about this much more as the semester goes along, in addition to wedges, you will hear about social cost of carbon, SCC. Again, just to sort of benchmark, make sure I'm not dragging you down paths you've already trod. How many of you had exposed to the social cost of carbon concept already? Anyone? No? All right. The idea of social cost of carbon is a fancy label for simply saying a way to calculate the cost of a ton of carbon into the air, into the future, for all social settings. If I emit a ton of CO2 into the air, how much will it increase mortality? What damage will it cause by increasing temperatures? What impact will it have on infrastructure? The idea that you can grab all the costs associated with emitting a ton of carbon and collapse it down into one number and essentially internalize, the same we talked about with markets, a cost for carbon, essentially then gives you a metric. And notice this is not a tax. You're not collecting this. It's also not a fee. There's no money exchanging hands. But social cost of carbon does essentially says, is this is the damage we will have to accept if we take this cause of action and cause the CO2 to be emitted. So, where it really has bite and why it's most important, the social cost of carbon gets incorporated in cost-benefit assessments. If a company, for example, wants to open a terminal in Jakarta, and then in doing so, they're going to generate multiple tons of CO2, and they're trying to figure out in a cost-benefit assessment whether or not it makes sense to build this port, many companies will actually take a look at the damage caused by the CO2 by using a social cost of carbon calculation and put it in the ledger against the cost of the profit and the benefit of constructing the terminal. Where it really takes bite is that the federal government does cost-benefit assessments in every new major rule it passes. So if you have a social cost of carbon and you're required to do a cost-benefit assessment, that means that you may have government regulatory actions that may make sense in a naked sense, but when you add their social cost of carbon impact, they're no longer past the cost-benefit assessment. So the amount that you would charge to a ton of carbon makes an enormous difference if you're granting a lease to mine coal on federal land, if you're authorizing the construction of a pipeline, if you're dealing with the permit to build a nuclear power plant. So as a result, the amount matters. Now here I'm going to just ask from your naked moral intuition. I'm assuming none of you are deeply steeped in this, but just wild ass guess time. How much do you think the social cost of carbon in dollars should be for a ton of CO2? And by the way, I will say there's no right or wrong answer to this one. All right. Let's say, I mean, if I said $100, how many of you think that's too high? Really? How many of you think $200? Still too low? $260. I can't go much higher. All right. Now I'm genuinely asking, what is your compass telling you is the right price then per ton of carbon if it's higher than $260?
Several thousand, if not, because if we're producing gigatons every year, that's billions of tons, mm-hmm. and so that would be on the magnitude of trillions of dollars mm-hmm. a year in social costs.
Okay.
So somewhere like that. Let's go 1,000. That's my final answer.
So 1,000. All right. I feel like I should pull another $20 for high low again. All right, Elizabeth, you won the $20 last time. So what's your number?
I'm going to say that it's too hard to put on a number because it's like, how do you put a value on like a species, or how do you put a value on like clean air? And like, there's like, I feel like it's too hard to value this.
So you're not gonna play.
Because it's like you can't see into the future, for one, like you don't really know all the impacts that are going to happen. And then we do know that we're already in a mass extinction event. So it's like, how do you, I don't know, I feel like it's too hard to put a number.
If you don't put any number on it, then effectively it's zero. And I'm not criticizing you. I understand completely what you're saying. There's actually moral challenges
to this. I don't think there's a too low of a number.
A thousand's too low.
Yeah.
10,000?
I'm going to say, like, whatever the highest number is that would get people stop emitting carbon.
All carbon?
Well, I don't want to be too extreme, but like,
then you have to have a price.
Over time.
No, I'm genuinely asking because I think you captured something important, that there's a certain moral dimension to this that the price exercise tends to overlook. I will also say that the federal government does do things like value how much reduction of a ton of air pollutants and clean air actually is worth.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at like health and stuff like that, but
and species,
for other things like animals, it's like how do you pick a number?
I mean, but you do flyers, right? And the life, even a human life is a number according to the government. So I know it's very cynical and you don't want a number because the life shouldn't have a number, but like you said earlier, you have to have a number because if not, then there's no value.
Right. I'm just going to say I don't think you can go too low.
Now, if you want to chill, exercise, check the workers' comp value for loss of bodily limb or life. You're a lot cheaper than you think. Now, I hear you. So could we just... I'll just roughly say $10,000? $100,000. Okay. So $100,000, $1,000.
But it would have to be like more than, it would depend on the activity as well, because if it's less than or substantially less than how much profit is to be gained in whatever underlying activity is causing the emission, then it has no bite.
No, you're absolutely right in the sense of, but I think the underlying value judgment of an economic model is that if it's generating profit to offset the cost of the carbon it's emitting, it's something society would still want. If it's generation of a vaccine that saves human lives, that generate income, which is cold-blooded, but nonetheless, it's something we'd want. The problem is, of course, if it's a casino that's generating income in a different way. Yeah. Again, let's leave the moralities aside. The economist cares about just basically the cost. Any others? Because right now, I've got 100,000, I've got 1,000. I'm sorely tempted to pull another $20 bill here to incentivize them to go high-low. Has anyone looked it up yet online? Darn, I didn't look. $40?
That's wrong, that's what Google says.
No, Google...
Well, EDF, and then
yeah.
EPA is like 36.
It depends when you check.
Yeah.
And what the weather's like outside, I should say. But anyway, the number fluctuates. Here's the numbers I'll give y'all, just to sort of tell you. I think Elizabeth has the moral clarity that EPA would say way too high. The number they ultimately settled on was $66 per ton. The idea was they essentially took the cost increment caused by a ton of CO2, and then they measured it in perpetuity, going into the future for 100 years. And then they measured it, its impact worldwide. Because remember, CO2 mixes super fast. And emissions here, not so much impacts emissions in China or New Zealand. And then they took that projected impact on environment and mortality and economic production, and then they used what's called a discount rate to figure that 100 years of damage and collapse it into a current price signal. I'm sorry if I'm, again, boring you with things you already know, but a discount rate very simply means a dollar in your hand now is worth $100 10 years from now. So essentially, work that in reverse. If there's $1,000 of damage 10 years from now, you only need to pay $10 now to offset it. So the rate, that discount rate, is enormously important. EPA created a social cost of carbon work group that assembled all the federal agencies and had them individually work on what metric they would use that they would accept for their rulemaking for a cost of the carbon. And they ended up with a range of numbers, but 66, 40 to 66 is right around the middle of it. Other groups, including EDF, including Stanford University, come up with numbers closest to like $260 per ton. Now, our last gut check exercise, in March of 2017, the new administration issued an executive order dissolving the Social Cost of Carbon Work Group. And is now, as of just about a month ago, proposed a new number for the Social Cost of Carbon. So I'll ask you, what do you think the current number being used by EPA for Social Cost of Carbon is? And I won't do a high-low on this one. If it was 100,000, or sorry, it was 2,000 before? I forget. What was the number I ended up where I could only go this high? 200, okay. All right, there's only so far down I can go now. So what number would you all guys come up with? Who says if it was 60 before, let's say 30?
I think it's like about 20 or 10. 10? So 10, you raise your hand? 10. 10. Less? 9. 5. $1 per ton.
What?
Did you say $1?
Yeah, is it written that?
Anyone else? Okay. The current number is actually 2. The current number is $7. That $7 number is based on a simple change in the calculation. Namely, the new agency does not account for worldwide costs. They only care about what happens in the United States. So, gone. The big debate now is, what's the discount rate I talked about before? They want to change it and make it much higher, which means that the price of the future damage gets discounted to a much lower level. If they make the discount rate change that they're proposing, the number drops from 7 to 1. So, stay tuned. This is the file I was telling you about. It's baked into one of the rules we're talking about in a couple of weeks, the Affordable Clean Energy Act, sorry, Affordable Clean Energy Regulation. Bottom line here is that this social cost of carbon is an enormously important tool, but it's obviously one that's kind of tough and hard to implement. It generates a lot of controversy in its own right. Okay, last question, chance for questions, anything else? Because our time's running short and I haven't gotten to adaptation yet. All right, then what I might do then is I'm going to go ahead and beg your indulgence. I'm going to go ahead and pause now. What I'm going to do is let you enjoy the holiday weekend. Rather than trying to do a final sprint to cover everything with adaptation, what I will ask is that on next Wednesday, we'll pick up adaptation. We'll talk a little bit about how adaptation and mitigation work together. And then we'll talk about how to essentially package those thoughts and generate what might be a strategy for Texas combining mitigation and adaptation. Ignore all the global stuff that we've been talking about. If you were to make it only things that Texas would care about, what are the things that lead to the top of the list if we had to come up with our own set of wedges just for Texas? And then that'll be about the first third of class. The last of the class will actually dig into the Clean Air Act and how it applies to global climate change. Quick benchmark question. How many of you have had a chance to be exposed to the Clean Air Act before? Okay, so we've got some baseline here, a little bit. I'll go through quickly how the Clean Air Act works, and then we'll talk about how to apply it directly. With that, last chance for questions before I release you into the night. Well, almost night. Okay? All right. I'll see everyone on, Wednesday.